My name is Warren Zola, and I'm the Executive Director of the Boston College Chief Executives Club. Welcome to our podcast of the March 21st Forum featuring Kevin Mandia, Chairman and CEO of Mandiant. As one of the top CEO speaking forums in the world, the Boston College Chief Executives Club gathers Boston's top business leaders several times each year. For this event, Kevin Mandia, Chairman and CEO of Mandiant, engaged in a fireside chat with Corey Thomas, Chairman and CEO of Rapid7. The conversation focused on all facets of cybersecurity, with candid advice on how to protect yourself, what to do when you've been compromised, questions to ask your chief security officer to ensure they're competent, and information on where the attacks are coming from.
Welcome, everyone. It was ancient Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu who said, "Nature never hurries, yet everything gets accomplished. Nature never hurries, yet everything gets accomplished." What a fantastic sentiment, especially for those of us who are procrastinators, who devised this welcome remarks on the drive-in. Thank goodness there was enough traffic, so we're okay there. But it also is a sentiment about the fact that it's a journey and not a destination. And understanding that where you get will happen, but how you get there is so critically important. On behalf of Boston College and the Carroll School of Management, welcome to the Boston College Chief Executives Club. I also would like to start off today by congratulating with heartfelt sincerity to all of us who managed to make it through yet another brutal New England weather, winter. I know that I made it through. I know there are people who talk about climate change. I put on a heavy jacket at least four times during the winter. I moved my snowblower to the front of the garage. I moved it to the back, didn't use it. Of course, here in New England, I did put on my winter jacket this morning to walk the dog. Now that spring has arrived, it's only appropriate to do so. So I also wanted to make note, we have three upcoming events that I'd like to invite you to. The first one will be on April 19th. We'll be back here in the Boston Harbor Hotel, our home. And we welcome our keynote speaker, David Cordani, who is the chairman and CEO of the Cigna Group. He will be hosted and joined on stage by our friend John Fish, chairman and CEO of Suffolk. I also want to make note on April 19th that coincides with an event that the Boston College Ireland Business Council will be having. Every 6 months or so since we played a football game in Dublin in 2014, we have created this council, and every 6 months we will bring either business leaders from Ireland over to Boston, or some of us will travel over to Dublin to discuss transatlantic trade and the values and the cooperation between these two countries and cities. We will have a group of about 50 executives here attending our event on the 19th. There are also some other events being held earlier that week, and we'll be having a breakfast at Bank of America on the same Friday, the 19th. If anybody is interested in participating or connecting with any of these people coming from Ireland, please let me or my office know, and we'd love to invite you to those events as well. On May 22nd, we will return to this room, and our keynote speaker will be David Solomon, the chair and CEO of Goldman Sachs. He will be hosted by a former keynote speaker of ours, Al Kelly, former chairman and CEO of Visa. And then the last event I'd like to invite you to will be held on the campus of Boston College. It's not a CEO Club event, but it is an event in conjunction between Boston College and the Federal Bureau of Investigations. They will hold the 8th annual Boston Cybersecurity Forum, and this conference will be held. Kevin Powers from Boston College oversees this on our part. Kevin, wave. Thanks for coming. And Kevin oversees this conference. Traditionally, the keynote speaker is the director of the FBI, and I will note that both of the two gentlemen about to come on stage have also both spoken at this conference. If you would like to attend that important event on the further discussions of cybersecurity, please connect with Kevin after the event or me, and we will certainly get you registered to join us for that one. Now, for today, our host for the day is our friend, the chairman and CEO of Rapid7, Corey Thomas. And I spoke to Corey about a year ago, and I said, our members are clamoring for a conversation about cybersecurity. I need you to help me identify someone who is the CEO of a company, who is a thought leader in this space, and who has enough gravitas to be on stage with you. And he said, I've got the perfect person. It's Kevin Mandia. And I said, terrific. Reached out, and we are blessed to have Kevin Mandia, the CEO of Mandiant, on our stage today. Kevin's background is spectacular. He started off as a cybersecurity officer for the United States Air Force and ascended quickly there. He has held gigs at private firms and has become one of the industry leaders in this space. He has written two books. He teaches classes. He has consulted and worked for both the public and the private sector, and has testified in front of the United States House of Representatives, as well as the Senate. All I can tell you is that you are in for a treat. I spent 30 minutes with the two of them on the phone in preparation for this event, and I can tell you the intellect, the humor, and what I learned was spectacular. Please welcome Corey and Kevin to our stage.
So Warren, thank you so much. Kevin, so good. Thank you so much for coming.
You can sit first.
There we go. So, you know, so I think the intros did partial service, but for those of you who don't know, if you are a company and you're in crisis, and especially if you have a brand, Kevin is the first person that you actually call. His number is on speed dials. Any sort of like law firm that focuses on cyber, any major organization, Kevin gets the calls for some of the worst, most difficult situations. We were just talking about these no-win situations. So I have one challenge for the audience today. We want to keep this live, then we want to keep it interactive. So I expect lots of questions. So I'm going to go through. I have a bunch of questions I can fill the time, but we want this to be interesting for you all. So think about your questions. What do you want to know about cyber? And I will bring them in throughout the conversation. But do make sure, because this is a rare opportunity that we have. I want to start. Everyone's interested in some ways about how cyber impacts their personal lives. However, cyber exists in the context of geopolitics, international conflict, nation states. You've done some of the leading work on understanding nation state threats and cyber criminal gangs. Can you just catch us up to basically what's the state of play with nation states? How is cyber used in competition, and what should we be worried about and focused on?
Yeah, and just, you know, the three bullet points you need to know about me that's germane to today is, as a public company CEO, went through a breach very publicly and had to report to the SEC and to my shareholders. I've been responding to breaches for over 30 years. And then during that response, a lot of people think responding to breaches is very tactical, but it isn't. It's very strategic because you have to figure out what happened responding to the breach, but what to do about it. How do you transform your security from point A to point B? And I've lived through that thousands of times. So you had asked about, so what's going on basically geopolitically. I think what's relevant for all of us in this room that should frustrate all of us is that there's safe harbors to hack us first and foremost, from the criminal element and from cyber espionage. If you're in Russia, Iran, China, or North Korea, it's a hall pass to, as I say, take as many shots on goal that you want, and that's it. So if somebody hacks your organization, not only is attribution complex to figure out who did it, but even when we know who did it, if they're sitting in Russia, China, North Korea, or Iran, there's nothing we can do about it. We have no deterrence to cyber attacks. That simple. And because of that, all of you who manage risk for your organizations are playing goalie on a daily basis in the cyber realm. And by the way, I am a depressing speaker. I'll try to end on a good note.
We're going to give you some hope along the way.
I'm not a fear, uncertainty, and doubt guy, but as I sit here, my company's responding to over 180 security breaches, and no one's going to get arrested. No one's going to get a slap on the wrist, and no one's going to get a surprise visit in the night. And that's unfortunate because it's a lot of great folks that have worked real hard to not have a cybersecurity breach, but they're going through one.
Are you seeing the same trends though? Like,
I should say this, there is a deterrence in the US, so if you hack and you're in the US, we do catch you.
Yeah.
That's the good news. Sorry about that. It's just that right now what you really need to worry about is foreign intrusions.
Yeah. Well, in the US, we actually arrest you, and if you happen to take a vacation—
We try really, really hard.
And if you happen to take a vacation and you're a hacker, then you can get into some trouble there.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about what trends you're seeing. You know, my understanding is that what we're seeing in Russia versus China, it's a little bit different overall. So talk to us a little bit about what you're saying
there.
Well,
you know, I'm a late bloomer. I started responding to breaches in 1995, and it wasn't till 2013 where I went, aha, breaches are tied to geopolitical conditions. So it took me about 20 years to figure this one out. But it absolutely is the truth. Right now, the good news with Russia is they're so locked on Ukraine that's where most of their efforts are going to. My company was hacked by the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service, known as the SVR. They're damn good at what they do, but they don't scale very well. Quite frankly, they're probably not going to go after anyone in this room because they do follow traditional espionage. They go after U.S. government, U.S. defense contractors. The FSB hacks a little bit from Russia. The GRU, their military intelligence, will compromise. But they're focused on Ukraine. The biggest concern for folks in this room would be if you make anything that can take care or help take care of, you know, the billion-plus Chinese folks, if you're a part of their five-year plan, they love to know what our IP is. And we generally think of folks going on offense in the cyber domain for security purposes. Is my opinion, China goes on offense for economic purposes because they think a strong economy is a good security. So if you add up all the criminal cases that we work every year, and we'll do over 1,200 incident response gigs this year, you could add up all the criminal, all of the stuff from Russia, all the stuff from Iran, all the stuff from North Korea, and it still doesn't add up to what's coming out of China. So China is a real threat, and we used to have like the Associated Press poll, you know, for who's the best on offense. In my entire career, I kind of take the U.S. out of it because, you know, the U.S. doesn't hack Home Depot and then we get hired to investigate it. We go where the breaches are, and I've never been hired to respond to a breach that we attributed to the U.S. government, but we've been hired to respond to thousands of Chinese breaches or breaches coming out of Russia. Russia was number one on offense till last year. In my whole career, from 1993 till now. Last year, the apex attacker in cyberspace was China. And what I mean by that, Corey, is they had the most 0 days, meaning they came up with the most ways to exploit you where there was no patch. They finally decided to have great operational security. They used to be the tank through the cornfield, and we kind of follow the trail. And then right around 2020, when cyber espionage out of China occurred, they started covering their tracks, doing counter forensics, using better infrastructure to attack us. You know, when I first responded to breaches out of China, it was like someone in Shanghai hacking defense contractor. That's an easy one to figure out because the IP address went back to Shanghai. You know, third graders could figure out probably China did it. Now they're going from Shanghai or Beijing or wherever they're located to IP addresses usually that reside in people's homes in the United States, and then hacking us from like a third grade classroom in Mississippi. And it's getting a lot harder to pierce anonymity. So China is the one that we probably should focus on. Iran is still following rules of engagement. They'll hack our media companies, they'll hack our military. They don't tend to hack in an unpredictable way. And North Korea is absolutely hard to predict, but they hack for money. Folks badge into a building in uniform in North Korea, and they hack to do Bitcoin mining, and to they hack the Bank of Bangladesh and steal things. So I just think
they're like cyber criminals, basically.
Yeah,
think about the North Korean as sort of the most advanced cyber criminals in the world.
That was the crappiest threat brief I've ever given because I didn't want to spend a lot of time on it. I just wanted to get to, I think what you, most of the companies in this room, as I looked at the list, it would be China or the criminal element. Those are the two things you have to worry about. And the criminal element is hacking to make money, period. Yep. Right now, they are focused on healthcare. If you want to hack somebody and make money, it used to be ransomware. We'd hack in, encrypt all your drives, and you'd pay to get us. You know,
why are they focused on healthcare? Because I think we see the breaches all the time in the news around healthcare. Yeah. Why has this become such a critical focus?
In our experience, when we respond to healthcare, it's you need to get up and on, you know, you need to get up and online fast.
Yep.
So you're more inclined to pay to get decryptors to do that. There have been times where the staff from incident response firms are literally sitting in the hospital with doctors going, well, you had a ransomware attack. Can you do this operation? Can you do that operation? Can you get the NICU running? I mean, these are insane conversations to have, and the attackers still have no risk or repercussions. I think most people, nobody by default wants to pay an extortion or ransomware. I don't care what you read. I've never had a CEO go, man, I can't wait to pay this. You know, it's literally default answer by every CEO I've ever met is, damn it, we're not going to pay if we don't have to. The reason people pay isn't to recover anymore. Yeah. People are getting compromised, and they're paying to protect their customers' data or paying to protect their actual customers. So when you think healthcare or hospitals, because you know, during COVID, you know, the pharmas and the hospitals were targeted by ransomware actors because the ransomware actors recognized that's the decision calculus. If I'm hacked and I'm a hospital and I can't treat patients, I'm probably more inclined to pay, you know, to get a decryption key.
So we're going to take this down to sort of like the executive
level.
Well, it's actually good though, because I think part of what's happened over the last 2 years is that people think about ransomware in some ways as I lock up your data or I'm blackmailing you from data.
Right.
You're talking about something very different as a shift over the last couple of years about what actually people think will actually get them paid.
Absolutely.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, when people break in and they're criminal now, you know, I've lived through the whole thing. The first intrusion I ever saw for money, you know, we went online and started selling things in, I think it was 1995, someone sold flowers online. It was like 1-800-Flowers or something like that, right?
Exactly.
So we went from that to accepting credit cards online in an unarmed, unprepared way. So attackers used to just hack, get credit card numbers and monetize that. We've gone through 10 shift changes. Now it's if I hack in and decrypt your, you know, encrypt all your drives, most people do have backups. You can recover. It may take some time, and you don't recover. There is no such thing as a perfect recovery. I can tell you that right now. No matter how many you have your backups up to date from, you know, 5 minutes ago, we always find hiccups, configuration files that don't work right, or whatever it is. But the attackers have graduated to, if we hack you and we encrypt you, that'll get your intention. You can't operate your business. You have thousands of servers encrypted. But most, again, CEOs are going to say, you know what, we'll recover. It'll take 4 weeks. We're not going to pay. We don't know who we're paying. We don't know how they use the money. It just doesn't feel good to do it. But now, let's suppose you've got a whole bunch of data of your customers. Like, if you're a law firm and you're compromised, it's devastating.
Yeah.
And if that attacker can get to just emails and steal emails. Like I always said, I used to red team every quarter at my company. And, you know, I hate saying this publicly because now some attacker will see this and go, all right, Mandy, this is what we're going to do to you. But I always used to tell the red team, see if you can get to the CFO's email, the general counsel's email, or my email. Because if you can get to any of those, it's a damn disaster.
Or their Slacks these days, or any messages.
Yeah, any of it. Exactly. And by the way, all our critical data at companies are on servers. Storage servers are called that. You back them up. Yeah. We all have this, I don't want to call it a single point of failure because it's a single point of success, too. You get all your files that are critical to certain things, different parts of your business, and you know, they're co-located, essentially. The attackers will get access to that and take that data. And a lot of times, what I've seen as the trend now, if you're hacked and you know it, your drives get encrypted, at least from the criminal element, and you're not paying to get decryption, you're paying to not see the release of those files. And a lot of folks will say, well, hey, if there's a bad actor out there, are they really only capable of one bad thing? It turns out, what I mean by that is, how do you know they're not going to publish the files anyway when you pay? The reality is they govern themselves. It makes sense to me that if I'm sitting in Russia making $100 million or more dollars a year, the minute there's an attacker that gets paid and still releases the documents,
you
people are going to stop
industry.
Paying, right? And then I'll leave you with this. The other perfect storm on this is Bitcoin's an anonymous currency. So you get an anonymous currency aiding and abetting, quite frankly. I'm not anti-Bitcoin, I'm not anti-China, I just go where the breaches are. All right, here's the reality. If you took away an anonymous digital currency, the extortion would be a lot more risky. Like if you had to show up with gym bags of cash, we probably could catch these people. But unfortunately, we don't get to do that. So, by the way, you could try to convince whoever's extorting you to accept cash, and that would be an interesting situation.
So look, you and I...
In Boston. So, get them to fly here. Yeah. That's called a win, actually.
Exactly. So you and I have both gone through personal compromises and breaches in our companies, and we advise people on that.
Yes.
So one of the things I think that's getting harder, so talk to people about, as the CEO, how do you actually manage through that, and what's your advice? Because you have your security technical people, you have your counsel who's telling you about all the ways you're going to be punished and all the regulatory things, and we love our counsels here. You have all these different parties, and so... As a CEO, how do you actually navigate this environment?
So I can tell you exactly when I get a one-on-one with the CEO's had a breach. Nowadays, they tend to go public right around the same time the CEO finds out. So it's hard to get in front of the power curve. And I've had to say the exact words that I've said over and over again. The CEO's going through a breach. I had to say it to myself in November of 2020 when I got a Friday afternoon security brief popped up on my calendar. And I'm like, oh, our security guys.
It's the dread. It's the ultimate dread.
I wonder what that could be. And I had just done an all hands, and I'm not kidding. I was like 30 minutes from a beer. And I was like, well, let me dial in and get the security update. It was November of 2020. 5 minutes into the security update, I'm like, we better call a board meeting. This is the one I worried about. And I learned a couple things from this. My internal voice told me the same counsel I told every CEO, this is your day job now. Because I remember a very famous breach where the CEO didn't make it. He asked, when do I get to go back to my day job? And I responded, sir, this is your day job. Exactly. You have to manage this. When I see, and I've learned from other folks when I've handled breaches, like Cognizant had a breach. I thought their CEO did a great job. I learned from him, customers first, period. You know, having responded to all these breaches helped me respond to my own and know you have to own it. And the reason why is general counsel will go into shield mode. They just do. Sales will go into, we can't lose any sales mode. comms will go into whatever comms does. And ultimately, you know, you've got to figure out how to just get it all to gel. I remember I had to write priorities. Like, we're responding to protect the nation first and foremost. I was lucky enough, it was the SolarWinds, like 0 day, basically.
Luckily, everyone got hit by that one, exactly.
Yeah, well, I was like, I doubt we're alone on this one.
Yeah.
And the other thing, too, when you're breached and you know it, trust me, other companies have been as well. And I've lived through the whole thing where every company got their first major breach. Most companies have been through it by now. But it is your day job as a CEO and a leader because, and to bring them all together, like sales, fine. You, my head of sales, my CRO, you represent the voice of the customer and how we're going to communicate to customers. I'm going to handle employees and shareholders. You'll have counsel in the room, but ultimately the words and what you communicate, I believe this, need to be the CEO and take on the tone of the CEO. And you had Kronos up here. I think Aaron Ayan is a Boston CEO. He did a great job.
Yeah, he did. Aaron did an amazing job.
He called hundreds of customers a day.
Yeah.
And by the way, as a CEO going through a breach, you have to just call your customers and get yelled at. That's what happens. How could you let this happen? And you'd be like, let it happen. We didn't let the breach happen. But the reality is, it's amazing. CEOs who think they can outsource the challenge, if you're the headlines, you can't.
Yeah.
And I would argue, what's interesting to me, if I'm the CEOs in this room, what I would be thinking about if I'm you is, how would I know if my company has a breach? Do they even escalate? Because when I got my own Friday afternoon phone call from my team always escalated early to me. And the whole time I'm in my call where I'm thinking, this is the breach I need to worry about, my team wasn't worried. And we were a security company. Because they were still thinking, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. It's
rationalization
is
a powerful thing.
They're like, there's just no way this could be the Russian SVR. I'm like, no, I think this is. And it was. I think all of you need to figure out, so what do I want to know about? Do I know enough to get a briefing early in this process of we might have a problem or later? And it's real important to figure out your escalation.
But there's an important thing here. So look, we talked about a little bit of the doom and the depression of it. But lots of companies go through breaches, and while it's painful, they survive. Microsoft has had major breaches.
We all do.
We've had, and so it's survivable.
Yeah, totally.
What makes the ones that actually survive it and end up stronger later, and okay later, versus the ones that it really just tanks the CEO and tanks the company?
So a couple things. First of all, I can tell you when I went public with my breach, we lost 20% of our market cap like that. So, you know, $400, $500 million.
You were in the middle of a complex transaction too, as I recall.
We were raising money from Blackstone at the time as well. Yeah. It's that was my all hands. Hey, we just raised money from Blackstone 10 minutes later. Hey, we've just been breached by the Russians. Great. Love that transition, you know, the seesaw life of the CEO, right? Did it. Oh, but it's real hard to tell. I can tell you, you know, breaches in the past, you look at, you know, the Target breach, there was some fallout to it. The Home Depot breach, in my opinion, was very, very similar. To some extent, I think they both handled it similar. Home Depot would say, oh, we handled it better. But some common patterns is just being honest, truthful, and genuine, and the CEO being the spokesperson. And I'm talking, by the way, the top 5%. This is every decision you make is automatically the least bad of 10 bad alternatives kind of breaches. If you're hacked and you know it, and you're 5 minutes behind the breach, you don't have a problem. Yeah. If you're an hour behind the breach, you don't have a problem. If you're 5 days behind the breach, you may not have a problem if you move fast. But I've learned watching other CEOs and then living through my own breach, the transparency matters to your customers. Yes. You do have to have your true north, whatever that is. And each breach may have a different one. Protect patients, protect shareholders, protect critical infrastructure, because your waterworks or your utility. And and it helped me at one point to actually write it out and remind all the stakeholders, because you're going to get a ton of unsolicited advice during a bad breach. You're going to have everybody yapping, do this, do that. And there's a lot of shareholders and stakeholders involved in a breach. But I've found the transparency of it can help. That being said, a lot of breaches, there's a fog of war that is longer than you want it to be, and it's very frustrating. I can tell you, one of the major breaches I responded to, I talked to the CEO right before he went public, and I said, sir, do you know how they broke in? And he's like, no, we don't know how a threat actor broke in. Sir, do you know what they took? No, we don't know what they took. Sir, do you know how long it's gonna take before you can recover from the ransomware? He said, no, we don't know. And I'm like, well, you can't answer any questions. Why are you, you know, why go public? He's like, I'm doing it. And I go, well, I'll do it with you then. You
know? Exactly.
Because I don't want you to stand alone with no answers. Yeah. And it turned out to be the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And I would have predicted and called against that. So that's a long-winded way of me saying, I can't always predict the government's reaction to your breach. I can't predict the public's reaction to your breach, Target versus Home Depot. But I have learned when CEOs go public in a genuine, transparent way,
well, part of that is that today, I think you have lots of people that are looking for a cover-up. And so if there's the slightest hint of it, it makes it worse in some ways.
Yeah, to me, here's the challenge. So I like to use the term, I'm not sure any CEO wants to cover up, by the way.
I agree. I've never seen I completely agree.
Here's what I would tell you. There are times where you don't know the extent of the breach.
Yep.
And if you divulge everything, people will jump to conclusions that may not be right.
Yep.
For example, if you don't know whether you lost 10 credit cards or 25 million, and you go public saying, hey, we lost some credit cards, everybody's gonna race you lost 25 million. And that's nothing. Imagine a law firm, if you say, we've been compromised, you lost some email. People will catastrophize to you lost every partner's email. Oh my God, all our litigation's gonna be lost now. That's the thing. What I've seen is when people aren't transparent to you, and nowadays, there's a desire to be, but recognizing transparency is going to create a panic that's undue, maybe. It's a complex situation. And I can't always say transparency is right. Like, I can tell you, I can't name the breaches in reality.
No.
But, you know, there are some breaches that I sat there going, I get why they're not sharing every detail of this breach. It'll create undue frustration for people, and there's not a damn thing they can do about it anyway.
Well, and I can talk about, without naming clients, some of our experiences, but, you know, one of the reasons that we argued before the SEC to avoid, I would say, strict time limits is because you don't know what you don't know. And so you want to have transparency at some point in time. And so, but it does bring up this question. There's lots of regulatory pressure that's actually coming.
There is. Yep.
That's creating some friction between, I would just say, CEOs and boards and some of the security folks on the teams, or some dynamics. And so can you talk a little bit about, like, you talk to CISOs all the time.
Yes.
What would you share with CEOs about what security people are actually going through as they're thinking about this dynamic in this world that we're living in?
A couple things. So last year in July, the SEC did their third iteration of making cybersecurity rules, and they impacted three things in our lives. If you're a publicly traded company, three things changed. They shared with you, meaning the SEC shared with you, if you have a breach that has material business impact, you have to file an 8K. To be honest, that's nothing new. To me, if you had anything, if you had a hurricane that had major impact, you're still going to file an 8K and let everybody know. So what they did do is provided a ton of guidance is what's in the cybersecurity notification. Mm-hmm. You do not need to share technical details about the breach. And people don't get that yet. So even right now, we're working breaches, and the security community is like, there's no detail.
Exactly.
Correct, because we don't have to report it. We only have to report the material impact to the business. And I agree with that, because you don't want to just tell the attackers, hey, great job. You hacked us and evaded all the
all the controls, exactly. Which brings other attackers, by the way.
But the challenge that these SEC rules bring up that even I'm kind of interested in is it goes right to the CEO and operational management, the governance. Who on your board knows, what do they know, and how do they assess your cybersecurity capabilities? So that means, you know, no matter what, there's going to be a focus on this stuff. There was a draft, going back now to your question, because right now I have yet to answer any of his questions.
I told you it would be a good learning experience
CEO,
no matter what.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's my public company CEO training. Just say whatever the hell you want. He can ask and you just go here. Here's what I would say. The original drafts were like thinking you needed a CISO or security expert on the board. I am very glad they removed that
completely
person.
Completely agree.
I don't think any board was like, I can't wait to have a security nerd in the boardroom. Let's use a spot for that. And the reason why is I don't think we've matured enough in security. There's not a lot of executives in security yet.
Yeah. And they're still learning their executive mindset skills.
It's frustrating too because there a lot of times you get the technical person, the engineer, and they've risen up the ranks to be the head of security, and you do need that acumen to be good at it, but almost all security is imperfect. Like, you can't pitch a perfect game every day. So you would need a security exec that recognizes genuine risk and can swallow the imperfections of your security. There's not a company in this room that wants the SVR to say, tomorrow we're hacking you, because they're gonna beat you. The nation will beat you if they target your company. I believe that. And it's unreasonable for the SEC or the US government to think you should be so good at cybersecurity that a foreign intelligence service can't break in. I think that's an unfair.
It's not even true of our nation.
The question becomes, and what everybody in this room should be asking, is how good do we need to be at security? That depends on industry, other factors. But back to your question. The SEC rules made CEOs and boards think about and focus on cybersecurity. So cybersecurity professionals should be enjoying the moment. Should be.
They should be. So here's the question I get. And then I want to open up for the first round of the questions. I have more questions. But like, here's the question I get from lots of the CEOs, some of them in this room. How do I know if my CISO or my security team
are
any good?
I get
that question every single time. Like, help me figure out if they're any good.
I got the magic code for you. We can't let it escape this room, though, because then they'll know and they'll pass the test. Yeah. The first thing I would ask a CISO, because most CEOs are not going to be so good at cybersecurity that you go home and you develop exploits.
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to go home and run Nessus scanners and vulnerability management tools. Here's what I'd say. I would turn to my CISO and first and foremost say, hey, how would you break into us? And if they're not even thinking about it, I don't think you have the right person. If you think about what the Secret Service does to protect the president, they're thinking, where would the shooter be? You know, he's going to be here tomorrow. Where's the shooter going to be? Where do we have to protect him? How do we get him in? How do we get him out? You don't even care what the answer is. You just go, hey, how would you break into us, Chief Information Security Officer? And if he doesn't have an answer, at least he should answer, I've got Bob on the team, and he's going to answer that for us. Someone's got to be thinking about that at your company, because that's like security 101, period. So that's a non-technical question you
could
ask. And also all you care about, that's the beautiful thing about CEO, it's binary. It's one or zero. Did they answer or not? If they didn't answer, I don't think you have the right person. Because that's all every CISO I've ever met is thinking about, is what holes do I have to plug? My God, what holes do I have to plug? And they should be up at night so they feel they've plugged them with compensating controls and with process and with technology. If you have a CISO that isn't even aware of how they would break into your organization and isn't thinking about it every day, that's interesting to me. That's like
that's a kind way to say it.
Thinking about not how do I protect the president. They're not thinking about it. And I know that's overly general, but I've given this a lot of thought. And there's two other questions. I'll just stick with that one for now, because that's the number one question I get after every breach. And the smoke settles and the breaches are public. And we are responding to every single breach you can read about in the press right now. And when the smoke settles, without a doubt, the CEO is going to say, how do I know if I was any good? Here's the second thing I would recommend you do. Red team your network. Mm-hmm. Get two or three people, give them 5 days and say, can you break in and make this become a reality? Don't let them just break in. Fine, they'll succeed. Break in and get the CEO's email. Break in and get to an industrial control system. Break in and get, and you don't have to make it a competition. I would even tell the defenders, hey, we're red teaming from Monday to Friday. The only thing that ever made me feel good, and it happened very rarely, is when the red team's not successful. Because there's nothing, I don't think you can do more than that. If you're a CEO and you've hired somebody to break in and they can't make the threats you're worried about become a reality, I think you should feel pretty good. You know, you're gonna wanna retest because your environment changes. But the red team will tell you everything, because if they break in day one and get everything day one, here's what you'll end up doing, because most CEOs have lived through this after red team. I'm less than 60 days removed from my CISO saying there's no way anybody could get the client data. So how did this happen? Or I've heard that every time we rolled out a production server, it's been patched. How come this exploit worked? CISOs are well-intentioned. They really are. I don't think they know what they don't know, and a red team answers that question for you unequivocally.
If you've never done it, most of the time it's going to be successful, I would just say, lots of times.
91%, we do, yeah. I think my company does more red teams than any other company on the planet, and about 90% of the time we're successful. So, now, realize success is this. Most of the time our customers say, we're going to give you access to an internal system to begin with. We're going to assume that somebody's been spearfished, or one of your employees has lost their credentials online, and there was single factor authentication to get in. Can you go from one host to many? They will. And that's okay, but there are ways to get your finance data. You know, there have been companies that we can't make a transaction happen, or we can't get to an industrial control system. And you do limit it. You don't want to give them 30 days to do it, because A, you're overpaying. And I can tell you, if a red team can't do it in 5 days, they really aren't going to be doing it. And because your adversary is not going to spend 5 days trying to break into you. I believe that. They're going to spend 3 or 4. If they're about making money, they've already moved on.
Financial ones.
So those are the two things to determine if you're any good. Ask, how would you break into us, Chief Information Security Officer? Well, I don't know. Oh, boy. That would be my response. Can you find out, please? That'd be good to know.
So I want to open up for questions. So do we have any questions? All right, got one over here. Go ahead. Hang on, we got a microphone for you.
Hi. Do you know whether or not the internal control certification in Sarbanes covers cyber risk?
Well, I think there's dozens of standards, legislation, regulations that cover cyber risk. And there's a whole, you know, it all comes down to everybody does need to pick a framework that they want to govern by, whatever that is. And I've seen all the frameworks, because different industries are regulated by different things. Sarbanes is just a component. It goes way beyond that. It's specifically in Sarbanes, there's like rule 404 and other rules. It's been so long since that came out, I think it was like 2002 or 2000, that it's just been contained within other emerging cybersecurity standards. Most people pick a NIST standard and go compliant by that. If they're regulated, they got plenty. And then really very mature organizations create a framework beyond governance that really the CEO picks, where the CEO says, here's the 5 things I do not want to have become a reality for my business. If I make healthcare devices, I don't want a death because somebody hacked us in cyber. That's insane. Or if I'm a production, I don't want production to be stopped because of a cyber event. Or you get I run trains, I don't want trains stopped because industrial control systems. The CEO comes up with 4 or 5 things with the business line owners, and usually the 5th thing is, and be compliant with corresponding standards, legislation, or regulations. It's 1 of 5 or 6 for mature frameworks to report to the board.
But consistency on the frameworks is the thing that matters most. About like pick one.
Pick one and roll.
And pick one.
They're
and roll.
All very similar.
Yep, exactly. Lots of overlap. Other questions? Do we have it? All right, got one back here.
What are some things that smaller businesses should do who don't have necessarily?
That's a great question.
The senior leadership team.
Yes.
Yep. Access to, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that's important, but there's a lot of small businesses that could be pretty vulnerable who could then be a pipeline to something.
And I'm going to turn this one over to you, Corey, because it might be like almost all the breaches we respond to are 1A enterprises. They're the ones that can afford it. And we're responding to breaches that give me the bias that we're up against pretty worthy adversaries, because nobody hires us when it's a 5-minute problem. You know, we only get hired for the things that circumvented really good safeguards.
Yeah, that's a nation state.
I tee this up for you, it is my opinion, smaller organizations outsource and do risk transfer on cyber. And Corey, you should talk more about that, because I'm a big believer in a space called managed detection and response. There's a lot of companies that do it. It's having, like, there's a poverty line. If you can't get above that in cyber, you have no choice but to outsource. And I even think in the 1A enterprise, they're having a tough time getting enough cybersecurity expertise. So I'd turn that over to you.
I think you're completely right. So the first thing I would just say is, one, I think outsourcing partners, and I do think we have to make it more cost effective, but increasingly there's a wide range of partners that you can actually outsource to, depending on the size of your organization, to monitor your environment for attacks. I think the second thing that is absolutely critical is to be really careful and thoughtful about your partners that deploy the technology that you actually use. We see more issues with organizations that just didn't have security as a thought in their original technology deployments, mm-hmm. That actually caused more concerns than anyone else, because in Kevin's language earlier, it's not that a nation state could compromise them, it's just that any average cyber criminal could actually compromise them because of the overall state of the environment. So I think those two things is having to be in a focus area when you deploy technology and make sure your technology is deployed. You know, I would ask the question is, have you configured this well, whatever the technology is, my email system, whatever it is, to make sure that you have the right cyber controls in place. I would do security assessments. You can still do red teaming cost effectively, the 5 days as a smaller organization, and then outsourcing the monitoring. I think that's key.
Yeah, I think on the red teaming, do it, reduce scope, though.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have everybody red team everything all the time.
No.
Just what matters most, you red team more frequently. And then I had him answer that, because 30 years in cybersecurity, I've never had a great answer for how do you secure a small enterprise that's resource constrained. The only small enterprises I've ever seen really jack up security far, you know, punched way above their weight, are small law firms where they recognize we can't lose the data. That's just, and for whatever reason, the Chinese government went after hedge funds and small.
Yes, they did.
Yeah, and a lot of hedge funds are like, you know, we're just going to beef up our security. But the only option really is you either hire way more staff than you want to support, or you outsource it. So I think it's going to be outsourced.
As we bring up the other questions, you know, one of the things that someone asked me, they came up to me and said, listen, our company does these tabletop exercises, but it's not very satisfying. Describe what tabletop exercises are
and
what makes them good.
Let me do it with you. It'll be satisfying, because exactly. Here's the reality.
Exactly.
Tabletops are in many ways are the biggest
describe
bang
what they
for
are
the
first
buck
though.
You could do.
Yeah.
It's imagine you're wondering, how good are we at cybersecurity? One of the best ways to assess it as well is, let's imagine the exact thing we don't want to live through, we have to live through,
mm-hmm.
and just spend 2 hours living through it. Make it real. If you're a hospital, we've lost patient records. How do we handle that? And I would do a tabletop where someone's feeding you the scenario almost in real time. We think we lost these records, but we're not sure. So you get a sense of the
ambiguity. Yep.
But here's what you get from that tabletop exercise. No matter what you've written down as your plan, you really need to just run this to see what happens. Because during a breach, nobody gets up and says, let me dust off our incident response plan and read page one. You want to know who needs to be involved, what's our unwritten document, like process. And you learn, do I understand the evidence? Like, I would do a tabletop where CEOs are really seeing, this is the actual digital evidence, to see if you understand it. I hate to say it, like, you're gonna hear phrases like, here's the malware the bad guy ran, here's the IP addresses they went from, here's, they used Robocopy to copy our data, the data went to an AWS S3 bucket. You'll hear the lingo, and you may not even understand it, that's okay. Watch the room, figure out, is the lawyer engaged, is what IT people were really engaged, did we get sufficient answering, should I have, you know, been informed of this or not informed of it? Tabletops are invaluable for when you have a real breach, because you've now met the people you're going to call when you've got it.
Yeah.
You know, I've got to get that lawyer involved. And by the way, if you have a breach and you know it, highly recommend you get counsel right away. period.
Yep.
Just to have work product doctrine, and you will be sued. I'm not sure I've responded to a breach in years where there's no plaintiff. And here's the shocker of it all. No matter when you're transparent and you're like, I'm going to tell the world what happened to me because it's the right thing to do, all your words are block copied into the lawsuits against you when you do that. And you just got to go, okay.
That's what happens.
It's what happens.
Do we have a question? Any questions?
I have a question right now.
Please, go ahead.
Hello.
I'm depressing.
Yeah. No!
Okay, thank
you're
you.
Informing. Go ahead, please.
Great insights, by the way. And I have a question really related to artificial intelligence and how we can pretty much, it's been really, I think, demonstrated that attackers are leveraging it to gain access to corporate networks. But what is your take on the defensive side of artificial intelligence and how we can help us gain an advantage?
I'll give you two things real quickly. On red teaming, we red team all the time, and we usually can break in. The times where we're stopped, there's some technology stopping us, and we don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. So there is security software that thinks and learns. Like on the endpoint, there's a popular software called CrowdStrike. Mm-hmm. CrowdStrike does adjust to us and our red teams. Yep. You know, so if we can get around them today, we may not get around them in 3 days. All the security providers are starting to have better innovation and better feedback loops. And it's not really AI as much as machine learning. And instead of generative AI, it's differentiated AI and that looks for anomalies. I can tell you, so the biggest thing generative AI is gonna do is we're building into our products, other companies building into theirs. It's gonna elevate people's security chops faster. It's like a training tool. So if you have a SIEM or let's say log aggregation, AI is getting built into those tools very quickly so that you know the threat intelligence right away, it's synthesized more appropriately. You're just gonna see people go from tier one analyst to tier two more quickly now with generative AI. But it's the differentiated AI, the anomaly detection AI, the machine learning models for identity security, for malware detection, simply behavioral analytics that's really moving the ball and detecting folks. I today think AI advantages defense on the attack plane, advantages offense with disinformation, influence operations, and ruses and guises to manipulate people.
Are there other questions? Brett.
I was trying to make my answers really bad to avoid questions.
So when you have this dreaded conversation with your board, telling them that you've
yes.
been hacked, excuse me, there's the ransom, there's the lawyer fees, there's
yes.
your fees, there's
yes.
the PR fees.
Yep.
How much does this cost? What should I be thinking about organizationally? Who do I need to be bringing together?
Yeah.
And how do you prepare your stakeholders for the ongoing costs?
Yeah, I didn't have to, and most people don't. Most people recognize it's a faucet at that point on the expense. And you're right, like everybody does hire PR. I did, and yet I gotta be honest, I don't think I used a single thing they wrote, but you need to augment your staff,
they want the good ones.
And they're a great, you know, sounding board. I've never, for the breaches we respond to that are high risk, cost isn't the issue. People aren't worried about it at that point. In my breach,
but you're doing really big companies by
yeah,
and large. You're doing
true.
Like
and, well, and insurance yeah. does cover yeah. a decent amount of it. And I was impressed with how insurance covered a lot of our own internal response. But I didn't think about it. And the CEOs I've met aren't thinking cost at that point. They're thinking, let me get the resources I need right now. But you're exactly right. The smaller ones aren't very costly. I don't think. You know, that's the problem with breaches. Yeah. They really are. It's didn't matter, or oh hell, it matters. And I would say the didn't matter is 98% of them. They're small enough and you're fast enough to respond that you don't have any impact or consequence yeah. that requires you to open.
And I think part of the gap too is just that while it's a lot of money, the reputational damage and all the other money that's actually gonna cost still dwarfs by a wide margin the direct
it's
cost.
It's rare that it's on for 8 weeks or more. That's
yeah.
the thing though. It is a high, yeah, it's like 20-hour days like this and then a huge sink. Once you get your totality of the circumstances, here's what happened. That's the problem. You're condensing the time cycle to get totality of the circumstances. That's where the costs are. But very quickly, I think most folks can say, hey, we don't need PR now, and we don't need as much legal advice now. And My gut is that's usually within 4 weeks, even on a major breach, about 4 to 8 weeks into it, you're shutting down some of the work streams.
Okay, so as we get ready to close it down, so one key question. Once you can say optimistic and once somewhat pessimistic. What worries you the most about the trends that you actually see from an attacker perspective as it impacts us? And then where do you actually have a little bit of hope and optimism?
So I don't really get worried about this stuff because I've had it for 30 years. That's like asking a doctor what catastrophe you're worried about and they're just in the emergency room doing whatever they do. I think, but I'm going to answer it anyway.
Okay.
It's an election year. I think the disinformation is going to be insane this year. It's going to be, and it's frustrating to me seeing that to some extent from the inside, that there's artificial amplification of far left opinion and far right opinion on all social media today. And it's being done by organized groups outside the United States.
Yeah, people are always surprised. I always say that concerns me far more than the security. It's just like,
yeah.
You're watching a playbook that's happened for generations about how do you actually create a dynamic where you incentivize the best people in society to disengage and be cynical.
Yeah,
and you raise up the, it's a playbook that we know about and just watching us be susceptible to it.
I lived through this in 2016 when I had an employee walk into my office saying, we think the Russian government's manipulating the content on over 160 Facebook walls and amplifying with like hundreds of Twitter accounts. And we didn't even know what to do about it. So as a nation, we've come a long way. We try to do it. But here's the bottom line. They don't even create content anymore, whether it's Russia, China, or just anybody in the United States. Artificial amplification of ideas is real. It is happening. And everybody's trying to do their best to identify it and shut it off. But I think in an election year, all of us are going to be, get this, ready? We're going to be lied to this year.
All right. With that hopeful note, thank you.
The good news, everyone in this room will most likely have to deal with the breach. The reality is, the good news is you can rely on each other. Like, it's amazing the help that CEOs get from other CEOs that have been through it before. That's what I would ask. Anyone who's been through a breach before, be open to the next person that comes along. Someday, there will be risks or repercussions to hacking our organizations, and that day will be a fun day.
Absolutely. All right, Kevin, thank you so much.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast of the Boston College Chief Executives Club, featuring Kevin Mandia, Chairman and CEO of Mandiant. To learn more about the Boston College Chief Executives Club, a program of the Carroll School of Management at Boston College, please visit our website at www.bc.edu/CEO Club.